Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Best One Got a Notebook on this Monday, April 15th, the day that Lane Hutson starts his career with the Montreal Canadiens. I bet it's unfortunate we're not on site to watch that, but yeah. It's going to be an interesting game.
Yeah. And, you know, for those of you who are listening to this on Tuesday or later, but yeah, I briefly considered pitching a trip to Detroit, but I don't think that would have been approved in any case. And so yeah. I think, gonna have to watch it on TV. But yeah, it's a good time for him. It was good to hear that he was, you know, he was welcomed the way Jordan Harris was welcomed and others, of course. But it was funny talking to Jordan Harris, reminiscing about his first dinner when he arrived in Florida 2 years ago. Joel Edmondson and Christian Dvorak met him in the lobby, took him out for sushi, and he was like, I was like, were you used to cafeteria food at that point? And he's like, no, I actually cooked a fair bit on my own, but I definitely wasn't used to sushi like that. I definitely wasn't used to seeing a bill like that, which obviously he didn't pay, but he got a look at it and kind of realized, oh, this is my life now. This is where I've arrived. So yeah. I'm sure Lane Hutson had a similar experience in Detroit when he joined the team. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how much more we have to say about Lane Hutson until we actually see him play, but yeah, very exciting time for him, very exciting time for the organization, and eager to see what he can do.
You know, it's Monday. We'll have our mailbag later on, but I can already tell you that there are some people that were asking about the presence of of Lane Hutson on the team and the fact that Mike Matheson's is having a tremendous season offensively. I mean, he's really putting his signature on this season. And people are wondering how the two of them, because of their potential similar responsibilities, how they might coexist together. You know, Matheson's been the quarterback on the power play, something that he had not done before in his career. It sure has helped him propel him to, you know, new career heights in terms of points. But Hutson is also going to be, you know, he's destined to be a quarterback on the power play eventually, maybe not right away, but down the road. So do you see any potential conflict or issue with their deployment because of, you know, how their responsibilities might conflict?
I mean, eventually, yeah. Like, not right now. I don't think now is the time to be worried about that. For sure, as we mentioned in the last episode, there's no point playing Lane Hutson if you're not going to put him on the power play. So, interested to see what happens on that front in Detroit and Tuesday against Detroit, if Hutson's even in the lineup in that game, which we don't know. But it's down the road, for sure. That's mm-hmm. that's the problem. But, I mean, it's... I think I would venture to say that Lane Hutson is probably already a better power play quarterback than Mike Matheson. As great a season as Matheson has had, Hutson's ability not only to find passing lanes, but create passing lanes, just with his shiftiness up top. We saw it time and again at BU this year, how just a little juke at the top of the power play completely changes all the lanes that are available on the penalty kill, and then he can find passing lanes to his, you know, to Matt and Celebrini for the most part, but, you know, yeah, to the dangerous scorers on that team. There's no doubt if Lane Hutson's in your lineup, to not have him on power play one would be ridiculous as of now. But I do think that having Mike Matheson on the team, if Lane Hutson were to start the season in Montreal next year, which is not a guarantee, but if he did, yes, there's I suppose, a conflict of sorts, but it's also an opportunity to have a great mentor for Hutson, a guy who has similar attributes, as we mentioned again on the last podcast, but still he's a good guy to mentor Hutson because he already went through a lot of the things Hudson's going to go through. in this league. So I think it's a little premature to start worrying about that. But you know, the Canadians, once they know what Lane Hutson is, it's possible if Mike Madison continues performing at this level that he becomes an interesting trade chip, but they can't do that until they know what Hudson's going to be. So again, I think a lot of it's premature. There's no need to be concerned with any of this right now. Let's see how Lane Hutson does. Let's see how Mike Madison finishes his career defining season. If indeed he can continue it next year. I mean, I was looking at it Saturday night and it's changed a bit since then. On Saturday night, since the trade deadline, Mike Madison was the fourth highest scoring defenseman in the NHL. He's now fallen into a tie for fifth with Matthias Ekholm since the trade deadline, since March 8th. The only defenseman in the NHL who have more points than Mike Madison since that date. We're talking a sample of anywhere between 15 and 19 games are Evan Bouchard, Cale Makar, Adam Fox, and Roman Josi. Mike Madison has 18 points in his last 17 games.
That is a good
plus
company.
It is a plus
that
four.
Pretty good.
Yeah. It's got one more point than Quinn Hughes, although Quinn Hughes has played two fewer games.
Yeah.
But, you know, more points than Josh Morrissey, more points than Zach Werenski, more points than John Carlson, Mackenzie Weegar, Victor Hedman, Luke Hughes. I mean, it's just, he's been great. And so it's, there seems to be a large pocket of the fan base that is eager to trade Mike Madison because his value will never be as high as this, because he could be the difference-making piece that could bring in a quality forward. There's lots of valid reasons for it. It's just unfortunate. I think Mike Madison's season should be appreciated right now. Like, it's really remarkable what he's doing, the amount of points he's put up. And it's just been a really quality find for the Canadians, like a really, really good trade to get that guy.
No kidding.
You know,
yeah, so. I know. Well, you were mentioning the plus minus, the fact that he's plus four since the trade deadline. We were talking about the fact that he once, not so long ago, he was threatening to establish a new record of mediocrity for plus minuses and you know, obliterate the old Brisebois and Galchenyuk mark. But now it's not going to happen, so that's good.
It's good for Matheson for sure.
It's great for Matheson, no doubt about it. But and now, I mean, he's up to a crazy number, 51 assists. So the Canadians have two games to play as of right now, as we record this podcast against the Detroit Red Wings. So he would need two more assists in those two games to bring him to 53, and if he reaches that mark, there will only be Larry Robinson and Chris Chelios who in the history of the Montreal Canadiens will have put up more assists in a season than Mike Matheson. So when you say it's time to appreciate it, I agree. There, he's got warts in his game. Sometimes I roll my eyes and whatnot, but there's got to be a recognition of what he's been able to accomplish and how he's been able also to embrace the role of number one defenseman when he had never been given those keys before. Mm-hmm. And he took them, ran away with it, remained healthy. And that's honestly, that's very impressive on his part. So,
yeah, he's riding he's going 25-32 time on ice per game as of now. So it's really, really a credit to him and has been so good as a spokesman for the team, as a veteran leader on the team, and just being always available, especially after losses, to take the hit for on behalf of his teammates, even when he's the source of a goal against or what have you, has not shied away from that. He can do it in both languages. Like, really is a perfect player for the Montreal Canadiens. Local local guy. Perfectly bilingual.
Spectacular.
Spectacular, has the flair. Does scores incredible goals. The shorty in Ottawa was another highlight reel goal. And yet, despite being kind of the perfect Montreal Canadiens player, there's this underlying doubt about him or desire to move on from him that I find difficult to explain. I mean, the Lane Hutson thing does have some validity. It's just a little too soon, but eventually that might be something the Canadiens will have to address there. But for the time being, he's been a great player. And he's putting up an incredible season. You know, I don't know. Did Andrei Markov ever put up 62 points this season? I think he did.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. But, you know,
I read fans and hear from fans all year round saying
– Markov's career high was 64.
Okay.
So he's right there.
Right.
Yeah.
It's good. That's his career. Yeah, exactly. Because that's the only time that he hit 60. So I hear from fans who say, you know, oh, this guy is coming. This guy is coming. So then we'll have to move this guy or that guy. But that's not how it works. Because as long as you have not made your case and you've proven that you belong, nobody's going to move a guy in order to give you a spot. Uh-huh. I mean, since I started covering the Canadians, it happened only once, and that's when Bob Gainey moved Cristobal Huet to give the net to Carey Price. But apart from that, and the Carey Price is in a level of his own. But generally speaking, yes, you have promising young players that are coming, but show us what you got. Show us that you belong, that you are ready also to take all the responsibilities that we could dream of giving you, and then we'll make a move. So, yeah, down the road, I think that it's possible. But in a world where that's true that Mike Matheson's value would probably never be higher. I mean, with a salary like that, he's under contract for two more seasons after this one at, you know, almost $4.9 million a year. So he's a bargain, honestly, at that.
Yeah,
for that production, for that ice time and whatnot. The fact also that he started to kill penalties with regularity this season. So there's a case to be made there. But my biggest issue, since you brought me on that turf, is not about trading Matheson, but the Canadians cannot put themselves in a position to have an even younger blue line that they already have. So if they choose to entertain this idea because that's their ticket to get like an amazing forward, well, make sure that you find a veteran to add to that decor, because otherwise you're going to let those kids, you know, sink by themselves. You need that veteran presence. But David Savard's contract is going to run out after next season. So Matheson is meant to be the only veteran there afterwards. Mm-hmm. So it seems premature. So people are eager to say, oh, how can we capitalize on this situation today? Okay, but you have to look at the big picture, and the big picture is that the Canadiens' blue line is already so young that if you are to move Matheson, well, make sure that you've got a veteran replacement to at least compensate for what you would lose.
Yeah, and even then, like if you bring in a veteran to play on a third pair, like, I mean, you know, you need to, those minutes that Matheson plays need to be taken by someone. Presumably that would be Caden Gooley, who obviously, you know, and I think there's some more offense to be found in his game. And I think he's eager to kind of show that. But again, jumping the gun, I don't think it's the time to do it because of the dynamics you just mentioned. David Savard might not even be a Canadian by training camp. You know, I mean, who knows what's going to happen with him on the off season. And you know, the Canadians prior to last season, you know, Kent Hughes talking before the season began, we don't have much eagerness to have a really green blue line. You know, that's why they saw value in Chris Weidman or what have you, you know, and so it turned out to be that, you know, Gooley turned out to be ready for it. Arbor Jacki became a regular defenseman on the team, and it turned out to be a very green blue line, and there's probably a benefit to that now. Like, I think Caden Gooley, even though he's entering his third NHL season, I think he's and missed half of his rookie season, is a veteran type guy already. You know, I mean, he's not a veteran in terms of games played, but carries himself like a veteran already, and is a big, you know, is an emerging part of their leadership core on the team. So, but he's an exception. You know, he's exceptional. He's been like that his whole life, you know, so it's not everyone is ready at that age to be like that, especially as defensemen, you know.
Well, even then, though, you might behave like a veteran, but part of being a veteran is having seen shit, and there's some shit that he has not seen. So it's just a matter of sheer games played, you know, and experience in the playoffs and facing adversity in different contexts than the one that the Canadians have been dealing with since he arrived at the NHL. So, but yeah, I mean, and that weighs a little bit like Nick Suzuki when guys say that he's mature beyond his years, and you know, Ben Sherratt saw him as a future captain. Well, we could Caden Gooley. Some people might say that he's a future captain, you know, in his own way. So, but you still need to log those minutes, play those games, and play those reps.
Get those reps.
Yeah. Speaking of Suzuki, he had an interesting quote in your notebook that I read when he talked about Slafkovský and said he's going through some growing pains, but I think everyone sees what's there to be probably a top five winger in the league. That's quite an endorsement. I mean, Slafkovský's great, but that top five winger, there's a lot of great wingers in this league, man.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, if you just look at the – just look at the scoring leaders right now. It's, you know, if you count five wingers off the score, like Nikita Kucherov leads the league in scoring right now, 141 points, winger. Artemi Panarin is fourth, 118 points, winger. David Pastrnak is fifth, 109 points, winger. Mikko Rantanen is eighth, 103 points, winger. William Nylander is 10th, 97 points, winger. Those are the top five scoring wingers in the league right now. Doesn't include Philip Forsberg in 11th, Kirill Kaprizov 12th, Sam Reinhart 13th, Matthew Tkachuk 18th, and I think Matthew Tkachuk, you could make the argument, despite kind of a down year points wise, is a top five winger in the league. So from that group, Mitch Marner, obviously haven't mentioned him, Jason Robertson, Jesper Bratt. There's like, if Slav's able to be in that conversation, let's say he doesn't actually get into the top five, but if he's getting 2 years from now, if he's a 90 to 100 point winger, then the Canadians are in a good spot, because we assume, and it'll be important to kind of test these things out as soon as next season, we assume that the type of game that Slav plays will translate to playoff hockey. That's an interesting type of player to have in the playoffs.
Yeah.
If he can be that. So,
but on your list, I mean, most of those guys also have like a true superstar sentiment playing with them. Probably that Panarin and Pastrnak, they're the leading guys as wingers. Kucherov's the best player on the Tampa Bay Lightning, but still he's got a very good player to play with. Not trying to diss Suzuki at all here, but the definition of what's a top five winger might not necessarily be determined by the number of points, but also if you were to take a certain player and put him in an equivalent context somewhere else. Let's say Mikko Rantanen, for example, who Slafkovský likes to model himself after, and he gets some inspiration from Rantanen. I mean, if in 2 years from now you were to put Slafkovský next to Nathan MacKinnon, well, probably that he would be a 90 to 100 point player, you know? And Rantanen too. What's interesting about him, because today the guy's a monster, and I mean he's 27 years old. He's 6'4", 215. You know, not a shape not too different from Slavs, even though Slavs a bit heavier than that. Uh-huh. But when he arrived in the league, Rantanen played his first pro season after his draft in the American League, and his first season in the NHL. As a 19-year-old, he had 38 points in 75 games. So it's only as a 20-year-old that he really broke out and became a point-per-game player. Obviously, point per game 6, 7, 8 years ago is probably not the same as being a point per game today. But my point is that it's in his third year pro that he really blossomed. So next year, Slafkovský could very well toy with a point per game, rhythm. If everything goes well, it would not be that different than what we saw from Rantanen early on in his career. That would be without Nathan MacKinnon by his side.
Yeah, and you know, when you talk about Suzuki and Slav, so to me, the Slafkovský kind of cutoff point that I tend to use is December 15th for the season. Mm-hmm. From that point on, you know, at that point he had already been playing with Suzuki and Caulfield for a while, but he really seemed to production wise take off on that date. And I think he got an assist in a game that day or whatever. And so since that date, you know, he has 41 points in 51 games. Suzuki has 53 points in 51 games. And you're right, a point a game today does not mean the same thing as a point a game 5 or 6 years ago. A point a game is not a sufficient bar to be considered a star, like a real elite star forward in the NHL anymore. You got to be doing more than that. But what's interesting to me is that since that date, I think prior to then, you know, Nick Suzuki is still the driver on his line for sure. But he became less of a distributor and more of a scorer because of Slafkovský's ability and Caulfield's to some extent.
Yeah.
Ability to distribute the puck really well. And he became a finisher. I mean, he's got 25 goals in 51 games since that date. That's roughly a 40-goal pace, right? It's without doing the actual math on it. And what I find interesting about that is that, you know, the Canes are going to have a really interesting decision to make next season, going into next season. Do they reunite Slafkovský with Kirby Dach, which looked so good through training camp and really could have made this a different season for Slafkovský had Dach not gotten hurt? And just kind of maybe might have avoided those first 2 months or so that were really difficult for him.
Mm-hmm.
Do they go back to that and keep the Suzuki Caulfield pairing going?
I wanted to ask you that because it's an interesting decision. They have three options because they can choose to put Slav with Dach. They could choose to move Caulfield with Dach and keep Slav with Suzuki, or they could say, you know what, that first line is so well balanced that all three of them will leave them together and we'll try to build a second line with a summer acquisition plus Dach plus somebody else, possibly Newhook. But yeah, it's an interesting choice because there are three options and not just two. And if they were to keep Slafkovský, to me, the most interesting development would be if they were to move Caulfield with Dach and keep Slav with Suzuki, because we've always perceived that Suzuki and Caulfield, you know, were joint at the hip and nothing could separate them long term. But if they're able to find chemistry between Caulfield and Dach down the road, then you have the basis of really two really good lines. And you don't have to really scratch too much and try to figure out how you can create with Dach a potent second line. So that'd be very exciting. And it would probably be, in terms of smaller versus bigger guys, it would probably be also a more balanced lineup if you went that way.
Well, that's kind of, I think that's what, and the Newhook part of it, I think is very interesting as well, because if you were to move Slav to align with Doc, Newhook sliding into his spot with Suzuki and Caulfield, where he had some success earlier this season, would seem like a natural. But, you know, the way he's played at center leads me at least to believe that he becomes an option as a third line center. And you know, if he had like some, like the line he's playing on now with Armia and Gallagher, doesn't really cut it as a second line. But if you have that as your third line, now you're talking. And it's, and ideally, you know, maybe you rejuvenated Josh Anderson instead of Gallagher in that slot, you know, like it starts to look more like a really good third line, you know? And so.
Well, you better be rejuvenated because Gallagher is playing some good hockey, man.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, but it's, well, if, I mean, if he's really rejuvenated back to Josh Anderson of old, you could put him with Slavkovsky and Doc. And that's a pretty imposing line. Yeah. Like there's a lot. So there are possibilities. Joshua was in the mix to fill out maybe that third line instead of Gallagher. And you have, you know, him and Newhook showed some interesting things. So, you know, Juan, Newhook, Army as a third line next year. You're starting to look pretty good. And then you still have Christian Dvorak coming back. You have Jake Evans there. And if you put both of them, as we talked about, I think in a previous episode, at some point, you know, a righty lefty faceoff combination, fourth line that you can put up against anyone and not really worry about it. You got the makings of a pretty decent group of forwards all of a sudden. And no, they don't have the superstar elements, but if, you know, Slavkovsky takes a step, if Doc, like a lot of ifs, if Suzuki takes another step, Caulfield continues scoring the way he has the last couple of weeks and gets more to, and starts scoring from distance again, you know, I recently wrote about his increased goal totals from in tight, which is a good development for him, but his totals from outside have dropped. And, you know, maybe that's the impact of the shoulder surgery. Maybe it's not, but, you know, obviously there was a study that I referred to last season that showed that it can take a couple of years for that shoulder to go perfectly back to previous performance. If all those things come to pass, then what Nick Suzuki seemed to suggest to me on Friday, that there is no intention from management for the Canadians to not at least be in the playoff fight next year, if not outright make it. Is not looking that far-fetched. You know, yes, there needs to be elements added. There needs to be offensive talent added. And I think Canadians management is aware of that. Yes, the Gallagher and Anderson contracts remain a problem, no matter how well they play, frankly. There are issues up front for sure, but I don't think it's quite as dire and desperate as most people make it out to be. It's just that it's a lot of ifs. There's a lot of ifs. If Suzuki, if Caulfield, if Slav, if Doc. But I think those ifs are plausible, at least. So I think just one degree higher than possible, you know?
Right. They are plausible because that's what that rebuild is all about. It's about developing. That's where the onus has been put on. And it's just a matter of taking individually all those guys and looking at what is there a trend there, or what's the tendency for each player? And if you project a similar type of growth from each player next year, it's reasonable. It's not out of whack. It's not a pipe dream, you know, it's legit. But I wonder about that, the playoff aspirations for next season. I wonder to which extent it would be based on where the team thinks that it's at realistically, like this is the team we've got and we're ready for this and that. And how much of it is also potentially a result of looking at other teams that have been fighting for a playoff spot and looking at your Pittsburghs, your Washingtons, your Philly, your Detroits and say, well, there's no reason that we can at least be as good as those teams next year.
Yeah, I definitely think there's some there. Well, listen, I mean, at one point Suzuki said, you know, had things gone differently this season, we easily could have been in a playoff spot considering the number that it's going to take to get in. I don't know about easily, but that came out of him. I didn't ask him
Right.
that. Like that came from him. So it's clearly something that he's thought about, where they look at the Eastern Conference, the way it played out this season, and said, man, we really missed an opportunity here. I personally of the mind that, you know, and this is actually an interesting thought exercise that I thought of when the Flyers were in town and they were getting pummeled by the Canadians, like, you know, and John Tortorella saying before the game, like, I hate that term, meaningful games. I hate it. You know, like we're here. We're playing those meaningful games. Let's win them. You know, like this is, let's get in the playoffs. The playoffs are the meaningful games, is what he wanted to say. You know, like these aren't the meaningful games. We want to play these games so that we can get to the meaningful ones. And you watch that game and you watch the whole process that Philly's, and listen, Philly could still get in, but you watch this whole process, and if they don't get in and they wind up with a 15th overall pick for their trouble, and they kind of like, was it all worth it? And it's maybe it was. That's it's not a clear answer. Like maybe there is value to those kids going through this and understanding what it takes. Because the fact that Nick Suzuki says that the Canadians could have easily made the playoffs considering the number, well, I don't know if he understands what a team like Philly was going through to get in. It's not easy. It's not, when you haven't done it, it's not easy. And Philly's learning that. And the Canadians don't know that yet. They might know it, but until you live it and go through something like Philly's going through, you won't know it. And that answer from Nick kind of made me think of that. Like, was it worth it for Philly? What value do meaningful games actually have? Like all these teams, these rebuilding teams, Pierre Dorion said it in Ottawa, Kevin Adams said it in Buffalo. Like, we want to be playing meaningful games in March, you know? And even this administration, Ken Hughes has mentioned that they want to be playing meaningful games in March. And Philly did that. What'd they get out of it?
Well, I
Probably
think that,
something, and it's something that we
yeah.
can't touch and feel. It's not tangible. Like it's, but it's something.
You'll only see the result of that next season. You cannot, if they fail to make the playoffs and they end up with a 15 pick, it'll be easy to say it wasn't worth it because look, they're in what Micah Blake McCurdy, you know the guy from Hockey Wiz, he says how do you get the he has a chart for that the not the desperate state but
It's the tragic standings.
the tragic standings were
Yeah,
actually
something.
yes. Yeah. So you don't make the playoffs and you don't get a good rank a good draft ranking either, so you're stuck in no man's land. So it's easy to say, oh yeah, well, okay, it was a waste, it was not worth it. But maybe that next season, the way that the Flyers would play, you would look at them and say, had they not gone through what they went through this season, they would not be able to play that way. So that remains to be seen. But I think that the Canadians would be in a position, considering how their young players are developing, to think that they could be the next year's Flyers, the next year's, or even the next year's Canucks. It might be a push because I mean, they're about to clinch the Pacific Division, so it's not going to happen with Montreal and the Atlantic next year. But yeah, to make that sort of leap forward. But to me, I always come back to the fact that I'm okay with them making a big jump forward and, you know, being done with the days of drafting high and resorting only to the hopes of someone that's not on your team already and just hoping for that miraculous prospect that you're going to draft. But if you are to make that jump, it's got to be followed by another jump. And it's just a You're just continuing to progress. If that's where the team is next year, so be it. But if it means that the year after you'd go back a couple of steps again, to me, that would be discouraging. So I'd rather see them take their time in order to climb the mountain progressively and be a very good team instead of trying to do too much at once and then, you know, things go south afterwards. I think I've made that point before, but I'm sticking to it. God damn.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's just it's you know, obviously the Canadiens' opponent over the next two days, you know, Detroit, same situation, yeah. Right? So it's but what's obvious to me from Nick's comments is this is something that's been communicated to him. He was pretty confident talking about how next year the playoffs are the priority. And so and I think that it's the way Nick feels about it, the way Cole feels about it is something that is of concern to management and that they want them to feel like they've paid their dues and now they're going to get rewarded for it. How the Canadiens are going to go about it this offseason, I'm not quite sure, but there's definitely, and we've said it time and again, but I think this just reinforces that there is a sense that they feel the time is right to make, to take a step and to make moves that are predicated on making that step. So,
but it's interesting because my impression was that they would be, their big moves, they would make them more in the summer of 25 than the summer of 24. But if that's really their mindset that, you know, they're going to aim for the playoffs next season, it means that there will need to be some bold moves made in order to help this team, you know, overcome that and get over that hurdle and reach that goal next season. Because it's the current state. I mean, the team's going to get better, but just the current lineup plus Kirby Doc, with one more year, it's a better team. But is it a playoff team? I'm not sure. You know, it'll need some outside help.
I mean, that's. But it's again, if they can put them, I feel like they, you know. I don't think Daniel Briere expected the Flyers to be in this position. I don't think Daniel Briere planned his offseason or even his trade deadline. I mean, he traded away Sean Walker at the trade deadline, right? Like but he did acquire Eric Johnson. Like he did try to mitigate what he did at the deadline because I think it was clear to him that even though this wasn't planned necessarily, that this is good. What's happening to my team at this stage of our build is good, and I need to help that. And I think that's all John Tortorella was saying, not only before playing Montreal, but he had a really impassioned explanation in Philadelphia to the local media about let's get in, you know, like we're here, let's seize, you know, carpe diem, you know, let's seize the day. We've created this situation. We've earned the right to be here and play these games and try to get in. Let's elevate. And let's get there. So, I don't know what the tangible value of that is for them, but whatever it is, I think the Canadiens would like to have some of that coursing through their dressing room at this time next year.
Yeah. All right, time for the Monday mailbag.
We do a mailbag every Monday, you know.
Let's go through the mailbag. Let's go through the mailbag.
Mailbag.
You know, to us.
Okay, so we've got thanks to everybody for sending us your questions either on X or I'm starting to say X instead of Twitter. I've fought it long and hard, but I'm finally giving in.
Elon always wins.
Yes, exactly.
Elon always wins. But yes, thank you for all your support. So we have a lot of questions. I don't know if we're going to get to all of them. We probably won't, but we're going to try to get to some. So, but again, we're going to try and get through them quicker than we normally do. Can I start with the two questions from our friends in Newfoundland?
Sure.
Okay. So we have two gentlemen. I don't know if they know each other, but two people from Newfoundland wrote us asking pretty much the same question. Ken Morrissey from Portugal Cove, Newfoundland, and Ken Fitzgerald, also from Newfoundland.
Didn't mention the town, though?
No, he didn't mention the town, so I don't know if he's from Portugal Cove or not, but in any case. Ken and
they were at the bar, they discussed it, and separately they went their separate ways and they started
they're both named Ken. So Ken Morrissey, Ken Fitzgerald. Ken Fitzgerald writes, as a Habs fan from Newfoundland and Labrador, I'm curious as to if the Canadians could look at a player such as Dawson Mercer from the Devils, who is an RFA this summer, and a speedy, responsible winger who I believe would fit MSL's style of play. Your thoughts, please. Thanks, Ken. Dawson Mercer, for those who don't know, is a native of Newfoundland. Ken Morrissey, Portugal Cove. Let's say, you have debated if this summer or next is the one Ken Hughes may pursue an enhanced offensive talent to expedite the rebuild, retool, or whatever we are calling it. From what we have seen, it's anyone's guess. But Hughes doesn't seem shy to make surprising moves. Goes on to talk about a number of weeks ago when discussing the drafting of Caden Gooley, Dawson Mercer was mentioned as a QMJHL player the fans thought the Canadians may take with that pick. While his production has dipped this year, Mercer at 22 seems to match the profile of a young offensive talent Hughes has been targeting. He's an RFA, given a January article by CBC Newfoundland that is speculative about his New Jersey future, where apparently his uncle says that he doesn't believe that this is a solid sourcing. His uncle says he doesn't believe New Jersey will sign him. Would you see Mercer as a player Hughes may pursue? And I just want to follow that up with another, because it provides context. This one comes from Francois Gallarneau. I will summarize here and not read the whole thing, but he mentions that we have mentioned the Habs trading a defenseman, and we've talked about almost all of them except for Caden Gooley. While he is possibly the most established defensively, plays a physical game, and apparently has a lot of leadership, would he not also be the one who would fetch the biggest return? And Francois goes on. So the reason why I grouped those three together, A, because I love that two separate Kens from Newfoundland wrote us about Dawson Mercer. So if there are any other Kens in Newfoundland who are interested in hearing us talk about Dawson Mercer, then please, basswingoday@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
I'm just Ken from Newfoundland.
Ken from Newfoundland. And then Francois mentioning Caden Gooley. And the reason why I put that together is because I believe even if, you know, Dawson Mercer still scored 20 goals this season. Yes, it's down from 27 last season. But he's got 3 years in the league. He's never missed a game. 17, 27, 20 goals in his entry-level contract. So maybe New Jersey's reluctant to pay him what Dawson Mercer would think that kind of career to date is worth. But if they were to trade him, I believe the ask would be Caden Gooley. And that's an interesting – I don't think the Canadians would really entertain that personally. But when you're talking about going out and getting – because New Jersey's not interested in picks and prospects. You know, they need someone that they can put in their lineup. Right.
Yeah.
Again, not saying the Canadians should or would do that. Not saying anything – not sure I would do it either, but when you're talking about trading Caden Gooley, it's clear that yes, you would bring in the most of all the defensemen, but the reason he would bring in the most is because the Canadians value that value. They want that value on their team. And so that's why I think we don't talk about Caden Gooley getting traded, because the Canadians really love him. And they're not willing to – the trade-off, and I think in Francois' email, it mentioned is the trade-off – is the dip from Caden Gooley down to some of the other guys not as big as the gap would be between the forward they bring in and some of the other forwards they have in the organization? And I would argue that that's actually not true, that gap between Gooley and some of the other defensemen, just because of just his elite maturity, like there's so many unique aspects of him that the Canadians appreciate, that it's actually, I think, a little bigger than you're giving credit for in that case.
Yeah, and it also goes back to what we were saying earlier about Matheson and Hudson, that it's the difference between the guy that's showing you that he can do it and the youngster who's giving you the promise that he might be able to do it. So that's why Gooley has got the step ahead over, you know, Hudson, Reinbacher, and the other prospects on defense or Mayu, because he's already showing you at the NHL level that, you know, right from the get-go, he was able to take a lot of responsibilities, and the room for growth is still exponential. So there's a lot to like. So yeah, to me, he's in a class of his own. I would totally get if the New Jersey Devils were to shop Dawson Mercer, that this would be the sort of defenseman they'd target. They have a surplus at forwards. They will have needs on defense. So if they move one of their forwards, it'll be to get some help on the blue line. And I like also, I think that New Jersey is one team that I would keep an eye on if Montreal wants to make a trade this summer, just because of the number of forwards they've got. So New Jersey and maybe also Carolina, they seem like good fits. But then this
Natchez being the other kind of Doc-like trade candidate that exists in Carolina. Oh, yeah,
for sure. But Mercer, I mean, if Mercer, I mean, he's been playing, what, 17 minutes a night for them. He's got, you mentioned 20 goals, which is eminently respectable. Mm-hmm. Overall, it's 33 points in 81 games. If he's considered the odd man out by New Jersey because he cannot really crack the top six and they've got other options, and losing him would be somewhat easily mitigated. I'm not sure that they're in a position where they would be dealing from a position of strength, because the kid has done great, but the team has not used him as to say he's our crown jewel, or he's a guy that, you know, that he's so good that if in order to pry him away from us, you're going to need to pay a ton. And I think that's what the Canadians have done with Gouley, because, you know, maybe it's because there was nobody else around who could do what Gouley ended up doing. But the fact of the matter is that he ended up a top pairing defenseman and number two defenseman on this team. And he's been put in that situation and he succeeded. So down the road, I think that Dawson Mercer is going to be a very, very good player. He's already a very good player, but I don't see a trade like that happening. So, but yeah, I mean, Mercer, they've got some interesting questions to ask themselves over there in terms of how they're going to fit everybody under the payroll. Alexander Holtz could be considered the odd man out, but he's got another year in his entry level. So
yeah,
if somebody else than Gouley could be entertained, this is a guy I would consider, Mercer. He'd be a great addition for Montreal.
And the one thing, when you say like New Jersey would be looking for help on the blue line, I mean, don't forget like Dougie Hamilton's coming back next year.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they have Nemitz and Hughes will be entering their second year. Mm-hmm. John Marino's a pretty good defenseman. Jonas Siegenthaler's a pretty good defenseman. I mean, I don't think they have a desperate need for someone like Gouley. You know, like, I mean, yes, who wouldn't want to add someone like that? But it's, you know, there's they do have they're also not in some sort of desperate position to add help on the blue line. The blue line should be pretty solid with Hamilton back next year.
Yeah, and they want to shop for a true number one goaltender. So if they go after that sort of fish,
yeah,
then you have to dangle a guy like Mercer at least to be part of a package like that.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, we've got Eric Seligman here who's asking us, he says, my question concerns Barron. Since he isn't waiver eligible next year, does he become next year's Caden Primo? As one of Kent Hughes' first trades and his penchant for only trading if he gets what he wants, does he stay on the NHL roster as a 7th or 8th D instead of losing him?
Well, I mean, that's how he started this season, right? So, yes. I guess like he started this season that way without the waiver aspect of it. And so the waiver aspect of it makes it even more likely if the Canadiens are unable to – well, listen, I don't think it should be precluded the possibility that Barron will play himself into a role on the team next year. It's that time for him. I was talking to him about it last week, and you know, I asked him if he feels a heightened sense of urgency in his career right now with where he's at with this organization in his overall development arc. You know, his answer was yes and no. No, in the sense that he just wants to show the Canadians what he can do, what he learned in Laval. And I think he's done that by and large over the last couple of games. Mm-hmm. Ottawa was a big test for him. Got paired with Matheson, was playing top pairing role, was second on the team in ice time in that game. Looked fine as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, you'd like to see more than fine out of him. So, but then he said the part of it that is urgent is that, you know, I need for myself, I need to show myself I'm an NHL player, you know, and that's not, that's a bit of a change from the beginning of the season where Barron was kind of saying, I don't have anything left to prove in the NHL. I feel like I am an NHL player. Like this season has created a little, let a little bit of doubt creep in to that. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's right to write off a guy like Barron as automatically being this guy who's going to be stuck in waiver jail and just practicing with the team just so that they don't lose him on waivers. I think he's still going to be put in a position where he can win a job at a training camp. It's going to be imperative on him to arrive in training camp prepared to win that job. But there's definitely some doubt creeping in from a lot of different observers that, you know, maybe this guy's might not pan out, but I think it's way too early to make any definitive call on him. But what's undoubtedly the case is that the Canadiens have reached a point where they do have to make a call of some sort by the time they have to submit their roster next season.
Yeah. Just I'll quickly add on Barron that, you know, thinking of Saturday's game, I remember there was a play where he committed a turnover in the offensive zone. Luckily, there was somebody who was covering behind him, but he gave the puck away. But other than that, you said he was fine. I thought that he was not extremely noticeable. And when it comes to Justin Barron, it's possibly a good thing. You know how we say that sometimes from defensemen, when you don't see them or you don't hear the name too often during the play-by-play, it's not a bad thing because they're discreet. They're just doing their job. Uh-huh. Maybe that if Barron, you know, in order to stabilize and cement his place in the NHL, plays like low event minutes and it's leaves a little bit the flashy side that is, I'll agree, has a bit of signature in terms of, you know, the way that he joins the rush on times. But if he cuts down on the mistakes and becomes a bit more subdued for the time being, I don't see that as a negative. So his end of the season, his last few games have been encouraging in that sense. But to me, that if the Canadiens cannot extract the sort of value for him, I can easily see them keeping him even as a 7th D and hold on to him just like Eric says, just like they did with Caden Primo and just bide their time and see how they can come up with a solution. But the big difference with Caden Primo is that there's always injuries on defense. So if you're the 7th D, you'll play a bunch of games. You're not going to sit on the sidelines for very long. If you're a third goalie, you might wait a longer time.
Yeah. Okay. Got a question here from Paul Sis, which kind of aligns with Lane Hudson's debut to come in a few hours. Some people highlight that Lane Hudson has the biggest trade value he will ever have, unless he turns into a Hughes or a McCarr. Considering the fact that the Habs might not be in love with any of the Lindstrom, McGinley, Katten, or Yzerman that might be available at their spot at the next draft, would it be rational to think that they might trade Hudson for a real top six player they like and draft a guy like Parrick if he's available? Parrick and Hudson look similar. They're both offensive-oriented defensemen. One is 6 feet. The other is, you know, he says 5'7", closer to 5'9 at this point. Plus, Parrick is playing in the OHL, which is easier to transpose to the NHL than the NCAA. It's like if this draft is really defense heavy, would it make sense to one are Hudson and Winnipeg's pick worth an A grade top six player drafted between 21 and 23? Two, can we get a better defenseman at number 5 or 6 in 2024 than Hudson?
Yeah, well, I think that there's a reason why Hudson was available at the very end of the second round is that there are teams that are doubting his ability to make it in the NHL. He's had a great, great college career. The Canadiens believed in him. I think that he appreciates that and he's happy to have his chance with the Canadiens. But this is, if you want to talk about Hudson's values, I think the value, I think that it starts now. It starts with showing that he can make it at this level. So for the time being, even though that the promise of a guy that could be super exciting and who could be an offensive dynamo in the NHL, even though that's what we all hope for, I'm not convinced that at this point in time, Hudson would necessarily give you the sort of forward that the Canadiens will be looking for. They might, but I think that Hudson's just at the beginning of his value. And you keep him on your team, he's going to blossom into a good player, and you'll reach a point where, that's what I think, you'll reach a point where you won't even want to consider trading him. So I don't think, and also if you say, oh, we're going to, because there's this guy, we're going to take that guy, ultimately they might prefer Hudson to any of the defensemen that's available right now. When they made the exercise and ended up drafting David Reinbacher last year, it's because they had taken a look at the defenseman who would be available for this draft, and they preferred Reinbacher, for better or for worse, more than those guys. Uh-huh. So now, they probably that their read on Lefshinov would be different today or on any other defenseman. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, it's a defenseman-heavy draft, but I really wonder if the if some of the top forwards won't end up going before those guys anyway. So
yeah, it's a possibility. And I think there's also, just from Francis's email, I don't know the Habs should not be in love with any of Lindstrom, Iginla, Katten, or Yzerman. Obviously Katten, the size situation there, you know, if you just looking at their draft history or the way that, you know, yes, Mesher was kind of an undersized guy, but they with that premium of a pick, I don't see them going for a guy like Katten. But honestly, there's nothing that suggests to me that they have anything against Lindstrom or Iginla or even Yzerman. I think they recognize that what everyone else recognizes in Yzerman, but they also recognize that he scores a ton of goals and he's really good at that. And so, you know, I don't think that premise that in fact, my read on it is that they're actually quite happy about the spot that they sit in, and they're hoping that those defensemen go before these guys go so that they can get one of these guys. You know, there's obviously some gray area with a lot of them. You know, they haven't seen Dimitrov live all year, as far as I know. Lindstrom's been hurt most of the year. Like, there's issues there, but I do think they like the fact that so many teams seem to be so high on this defense group that some of the forwards could drop to them. And frankly, the way they're positioned right now at number five, that they might not even need to really play out that way. No matter how it plays out, they could have access to one of those forwards, because there's no way all of them are going in the top five. So, and the other thing being that the whole thing that the Canadians the whole build is based on cranking up the clock and getting it moving forward.
Yeah.
If you trade Hudson and take Parrick, then you've moved it back.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. So this is not what the Canadians are trying to do. They want to speed up the clock, not slow it down. And so that would be, you know, you waited whatever it did, 2 years for Hudson to arrive. Now he's here. And to trade him at that moment just seems counterproductive. So,
But come to think of it, what the listener suggests is that it's traded for an established winger. So in that sense, you're not scaling it back.
Right.
Because you're scaling it back in terms of adding
that piece.
Yeah.
That offensive defenseman piece. And so that's, yeah. I mean, it's, yes, if you manage to get that, but again, and I don't even know, because of that element of doubt around the league, like, I don't even know how much trade value he even has. And can we just watch the kid play for a little bit before we talk about trading him? Like, I mean, it's like,
trade everybody. That's the thing right now. Yeah.
Let's just watch him play. I think it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Enjoy watching Lane Hudson play.
Yeah.
We could talk about trading him some other time. But mm-hmm. for now, just enjoy watching him play. Okay, one more.
Okay, okay. Guys, I love your podcast, but I would consider trading you guys. No, that's not it. Okay, so Tom Hearn, is Luke Tuck signing? And do you see him fighting for a bottom six role next year? I watched his final game and thought he was impressive. So we are recording this podcast on Monday afternoon. It is 4:13 p.m. The Canadians expect to announce the signing of Luke Tuck either tonight or tomorrow morning. There's been an issue in regards to do they burn a year or not, but Luke Tuck is finishing his college career. He would have the choice to just leave as a free agent and go somewhere else. So he's got some leverage there in forcing the Canadians to burn a year of his contract right from the get-go uh-huh. so that he gets to his second contract faster. So we'll see if it gets done. I mean, it was announced on Sunday that it was, you know, all but a done deal, and it's been taking a bit longer. We'll see how that goes, but it still looks as though Tuck, for all intents and purposes, will sign with the Montreal Canadiens. So that would enable him afterwards to, sign an ATO, an amateur tryout with the Laval Rocket. His contract, actually, he would
sign an ATO if it started next year. If his NHL contract starts next year, he could sign an ATO and go to Laval. This is what essentially Lane Hutson would not do, right? I mean, this was not an option with Lane Hutson because he wouldn't be willing to do that. And he had more leverage in this situation than Luke Tuck, despite Tuck yeah. having the option of waiting till August and hitting free agency. It's the matter of, do you get to burn your first year of your NHL entry level, or do you sign an entry level that starts next season and you sign an ATO and you go play in Laval for the last couple of games? That's the crux of this. And it's been the crux of this situation for a long time, much longer than the last few weeks. You know, this has yeah. kind of been what the Canadians and Tuck's camp have been grappling with for a while now.
You were mentioning earlier, you know, the Canadians with all their guys could end up having a fourth line with Dvorak and Evans and whatnot. It suggests as though there's going to be a lot of guys on that roster next year, and it's going to be difficult for a newcomer to grab a spot right from the get-go. So when Tom asks us, do you see him fighting for a bottom six role next year? I would tell you no, not right off the bat, but eventually I think that they will sign him because they see his player profile as somebody who could help out at some point. But right from the end of the beginning of next training camp, I don't think so, because there are other guys like Heinemann, like Hua, some youngsters that will probably, they'll try to find them a spot quicker. There's always a guy that comes out and surprises everybody. Luke Tuck could be that guy. But I would expect that he would play a little bit in the American League before he earns a spot in the NHL. I don't see him fighting for a bottom six spot starting in October.
Right. And the Canadiens' future bottom six is starting to take shape. I mean, you have Owen Beck, who's going to be turning pro at the end of the season. Florian Jacquet just arrived in Laval. Who knows if he's going to stay there next season or go back to the OHL for his overage year. But another guy who could play a bottom six role, Luke Tuck, is another guy. So you're starting to add elements to the team that are separate from what they're trying to build offensively up front, at least.
Yeah, and it's good that they have that type of player.
Variety.
They need that. They need variety. Yeah. Okay. So, did you have one more?
No, that's it for this week. Thanks for everyone for listening. We're going to be back on Friday, which is going to be, I guess, our post-mortem episode. Kent Hughes and Jeff Gordon are going to address the media Wednesday morning at 9:30 AM. Then there's going to be the players. There's going to be obviously a lot of stuff to write about this season. This is, I guess, the last episode of the regular season, but we will have one on Friday, kind of breaking down what was said about this season, what to look ahead for in the off season, and everything that, you know, Cam Hughes and Jeff Gordon kind of talked about. So enjoy the last two games of the season, and we will talk to you on Friday.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.